Support for Open Spaces podcast comes from the Hobbs School of Environment and Natural Resources at the University of Wyoming, uwyo.edu/haub.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Ahead on the show, with Trump about to take over the White House, the coal industry's relieved it won't have to comply with a new rule curbing carbon dioxide emissions.
They were going to shut the industry down. That does not exist anymore, those fears.
In Washington, Wyoming's U.S. senators are working to overhaul the Affordable Care Act, but Senator Mike Enzi says it will be done with baby steps.
We're going to take the most critical parts and fix them as fast as we can, but parts is what we're talking about.
We'll hear how hard it is for Native Americans to find rentals in reservation border communities due to housing discrimination.
That's the first question. Do you party? Do you drink? Do you have a lot of people? Because they already assume I'm going to do something like that.
Those stories and more coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Wyoming's two senators are set to play a key role in the Republican effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo has the story on the tough road ahead for their effort.
You've probably heard that Senate Republicans took the first steps towards repealing Obamacare this week. Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi led that effort. I caught up with him yesterday to chat about the all-night ordeal. My first question to Enzi was what time he got to bed on Thursday.
About 4:30 this morning. So we didn't get out of here until after 1:30. And then you have a lot of adrenaline buildup when you're handling amendment after amendment with only 2 minutes of debate in between each amendment.
As for what the Senate actually passed along party lines on Thursday morning, Enzi borrows a metaphor from Health Committee Chairman Lamar Alexander of Tennessee.
The problem that we have is that the bridge of Obamacare is collapsing. And the first thing you got to do when a bridge is collapsing is send out a rescue team. And that's all we did, was send out a rescue team. Now the rescue team has to see that people don't fall into the river, and that we get a number of different ways of getting across that same river.
As for that rescue team, Democrats say they've been given an impossible task if Republicans repeal the health law before replacing it. But Enzi counters that the GOP plan is much less complicated than the comprehensive attempt Democrats passed under President Obama.
It's only hard to grasp if you're anticipating that we're going to do a 2,700-page bill to fix it all at once. We're going to take the most critical parts and fix them as fast as we can. But parts is what we're talking about. Different bridges going across the river.
While President-elect Trump has talked about lowering prescription drug costs, Enzi says he's pushing things like health savings accounts, buying insurance across state lines, and setting up regional health associations or pools. He says he's been floating those ideas for a decade, and he's got proof.
When I got home last night, my wife had found this button, which is 10 steps, 10 stops to transform health care in America. And I did that over 10 years ago as we came up with a plan for, and I worked with Senator Kennedy on this, for a plan where we could get everybody who wanted insurance to have insurance. Now, we found that there are some people that do not want insurance, and we didn't feel compelled to force them to have insurance.
As for the politics of the GOP's replacement effort, Wyoming's junior Senator John Barrasso is a part of the Republican leadership team in the upper chamber. While he's a doctor, he's also been key to the party's anti-Obamacare messaging campaign over the past few election cycles.
We want to protect patients. No one is going to lose their insurance after we repeal this and the next day.
The key to what he said is the next day, as in they may lose their insurance down the road. Democrats say the GOP has produced no plan to keep those millions of people insured. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy says his party will call the GOP's bluff if they propose a plan that rips away millions of people's health insurance.
Yeah, they can't get from here to there right now, but as long as we keep them committed to there, which is a replacement plan that looks and feels just like the ACA does for the 20 million people who have it, that's a good place for us to be.
But Barrasso maintains his party can keep millions of people covered, even without the current mandate for everyone in the nation to be insured.
The individual mandate that you have to buy a government-approved product, I believe, is illegal. The Supreme Court ruled differently, called it a tax. But the people of Wyoming know that this is the most unpopular part of the health care law. People of Wyoming are not going to tolerate it, and I'm not going to tolerate it. And to me, it's part of the initial repeal bill. It's one of the reasons that we have to repeal the health care law.
With the Republican Party in disagreement on how exactly to change the health care system after it was extended to millions of Americans for the first time, critics fear the transition will be chaotic and messy, which is what Democrats are banking on as they ramp up their efforts to win back voters in the 2018 midterm elections. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Over the past few months, we've been looking at the housing crisis on the Wind River Indian Reservation. The shortage of homes there and the lack of funding to build more has led to overcrowding and homelessness. Many Native Americans are often forced to find rentals in border communities off the reservation. But as Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports, even there, they still struggle to find places to live because of racial discrimination.
Ken Heba grew up in Denver, but a few years ago he moved to Lander to get a job as a nurse and to be closer to his Eastern Shoshone family members on the reservation. A few months ago, he had a falling out with his landlord and moved out. Since then, Heba has been unable to find a new place to live. He says he doesn't need much.
More like a one-bedroom, just for me.
Heba says until he finds his own place, he's forced to double up with his sister in Fort Washakie. He says even with his good credit and references, landlords just won't rent to him.
That's the first question. Do you party? Do you drink? Do you have a lot of people? Because they already assume I'm going to do something like that. And that's where I feel I'm being discriminated because of my race.
Such stories are common in Fremont County, says Jane Juvie. She's the community relations ombudsman in the Riverton Police. Her position was created in 2015 after a white City Park employee shot two Native Americans at a recovery center in town. One Native woman told Juvie about the time that she tried to arrange to view an apartment over the phone.
When the landlord saw that she was Native American, the rent that she'd been told was going to be charged over the phone all of a sudden went up by $600 or $700, and there was no way she could afford it.
Because of such cases, Juvie helped host a training in Riverton last summer for landlords to teach them about Wyoming's fair housing law. She says a lot of times landlords are biased unknowingly. For instance, turning away tenants who don't have much credit history or refusing to rent to someone because of their last name.
Yeah, the stigma of, oh, I rented to someone in that family before, so never again, even though it might be a cousin 12 times removed, right.
Juvie says such things can qualify as discrimination. I take a ride with landlord Dave Kellogg in his old VW Bug to see some of the apartment buildings he owns around Lander.
This is an apartment house, and interestingly, this little trailer court is mine also. The trailers are individually owned.
Kellogg says mostly he rents two-bedroom, one-bath apartments, charging about $650 a month, a good deal for low-income families. But over the years, Kellogg has learned to set strict rules.
I had a rental manager for a while who would just rent to anybody. And I finally had to fire him and throw everybody out because I just had the place was just trashed. Spent about $15,000 fixing it. And then I'm now re-renting that, but I'm being very, very careful.
Careful by requiring tenants to provide detailed credit histories and plenty of references, something Native American applicants don't always have.
The Native Americans are less able, in many instances, to meet the amount of information I want to have on that credit application.
Like, can you give me some examples?
A lot of them don't have a bank account.
He tries to be flexible on an individual basis, but he says he can't treat his rental business like a charity because he has too much money at stake. Still, there are some things he won't budge on, like only allowing one family per apartment. This one might be the hardest for Native families because many prefer to live multi-generationally. Kellogg says most of the time people comply, but a few years back...
I had one, and now unfortunately it was Native American, that moved in, she and her boyfriend, and they had a couple of kids. And then all of a sudden there was five kids in the apartment. And nobody wanted to admit to where they came from or do anything about getting them out.
So Kellogg asked them to leave. I told this story to Lyle Conkle, the field director for housing and urban development in Casper.
Was that one in his rights?
No. The fair housing law is oftentimes, as I said before, they discriminate unknowingly. You cannot put a number on how many people can live in a unit.
But Conkle says Dave Kellogg was in his rights as a landlord to use a strict credit history application, but...
Here's the key. If you treat them like you treat everybody else in your application process, that's acceptable. But everyone has to be treated the same.
Conkle says he only wishes more Native Americans would file housing discrimination complaints so HUD could have a better idea how pervasive discrimination is in reservation border towns. A 2003 HUD study shows that 1 in 4 Native American renters experience housing discrimination in their life. But in the last 10 years, only 4 people filed for racial discrimination in Fremont County. Meanwhile, the struggle to find a home there continues for Ken Heba, still living stacked up with his sister on the reservation.
I'm just like, if someone would rent me a place, I will take it.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
When we come back, we'll learn about a new partnership at UW that looks at how well the school prepares future teachers. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Wyoming is facing big questions about how to sustain the current education funding model, and that may cause uncertainty for educators entering the workforce. Almost half of Wyoming teachers graduate from the University of Wyoming, and so a new partnership with the Daniels Fund will shed light on how well the College of Education prepares those teachers. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson spoke with Rebecca Watts, the executive director of the Trustees Education Initiative, about what this partnership means for learning in Wyoming.
So the Trustees Education Initiative is an effort that is working on the College of Education and its continuous improvement.
What has been the sort of big question that's on your mind as you're tasked with trying to figure that out?
Probably the biggest question that has arisen so far, and everyone that's working on this, we share this question, and this is the first piece of work that we'll do, is defining what the expectations are and how you measure those so that when we look at the College of Education and all of its individual programs, whether it's elementary education, early childhood education, special education, secondary education, the full array of programs, how do we measure if improvement is actually happening? And there will be lots of questions that arise after that, but that's really the most important key question that we have to answer at the outset so that we know that, in fact, we are making gains and we are making progress.
We hear a lot about assessing student performance. You know, to what extent is that model of assessing students already sort of looping back around to the preparation of our teachers?
It loops around in that the preparation of teachers, the preparation of counselors and principals and superintendents, all educator preparation is focused on student success, the K-12 student success, P-12 actually, preschool through grade 12 student success. But how we define that and measure that varies a little bit by state, and in some ways it varies a little bit by school district. One thing that Wyoming does not do is attribute student gains to a particular teacher. They attribute student gains by school, but they don't break it down and say the growth that the students in Miss Smith's first grade class are attributable to her. And so
that's been one of our challenges, because if, in fact, we had some sort of student growth data attributable to an individual teacher, then we could measure how University of Wyoming graduates' students are doing once those graduates are out in the schools teaching compared to the graduates of other universities. That is not a metric that we have available to us in Wyoming. And I will say this, it's an open debate on whether student growth should be attributed to an individual teacher or not. So I understand the debate around it, but where we are right now is we don't have those kinds of data available to us. So we have to define student success in different ways that can be attributed to a particular teacher. Because, again, and this is not about calling out a teacher or calling out a graduate of a program and saying, you're doing a great job, you're doing a mediocre job, you're really struggling. What this is about is trying to measure the readiness for success of University of Wyoming College of Education graduates, and in doing so, to look at them in comparison to the graduates of other university programs.
And I know that you moved here from Ohio, where you also focused some on teacher preparation. And so I'm wondering, you know, coming into Wyoming, you know, we've talked about some of the challenges in terms of assessment, but what are the assets that you've identified in this state? What's unique?
What was exciting for me about coming to Wyoming to do this work is there is one university in the state that prepares teachers. There are community colleges that begin that preparation, but one public university in the entire state of Wyoming that prepares teachers. So from a making gains perspective, it was something you could get your arms around. My most recent employment in Ohio, as you mentioned, I was at the Ohio Department of Higher Education. We had in the state, not even counting the out-of-state institutions that had approval to operate in Ohio, in the state we had 51 colleges and universities that were preparing teachers. So from that perspective, it's in Wyoming, it's a lot easier to get your arms around. Many fewer school districts as well. So hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of school districts in Ohio, and fewer than 50 in the state of Wyoming. So it was an opportunity to come in here and to really kind of be able to focus on one university and a much smaller set of school districts to make this work happen.
What's happening here in Wyoming that's going to potentially have an impact on how we talk about and think about education throughout the country?
Wyoming's uniqueness is that it's this very large landmass with not a hugely dense population. There are other places in the country that face the same challenges. And the challenges come into place when we are looking at doing those early fieldwork placements for candidates. It becomes burdensome for them if they are having to drive 5.5-6 hours to do some early field work or to do a student teaching placement, have to uproot from maybe even having a rental here in Laramie and then all of a sudden for a full semester or maybe even a full year going out someplace very, very far away in the state. There are ways to do this work and address those challenges. And that's some of the things we'll be looking at with the initiative. So one of the things that we believe that Wyoming can contribute to a national conversation is ways to overcome the challenges of rural placements in sparsely populated areas that still bring a very robust experience to everyone involved.
I'm curious, how does funding, especially with impending budget cuts in Wyoming, impact your thinking about how to prepare teachers for classrooms, especially where access to resources may be uncertain?
One of the big challenges that we have in front of us with the initiative is that we have to find ways for sustaining these practices that we know to be very robust and produce great outcomes. And so we have to be clear about identifying the needs for resources and then identifying where those resources will come from. And historically in Wyoming, it has been, well, we'll just look to state funding to support those kinds of models. And the initiative is one example of a way to look beyond that and to go and seek grant funding from an external source, the Daniels Fund in this instance, and use those resources to raise the bar, to really make that work very, very effective and produce the kinds of outcomes that we want to see in Wyoming. And to sustain that moving forward, we can't solely rely on state funding to be able to sustain new models. We'll have to continue to look for leveraging support from external sources. And when we think about the benefit that this work will bring, it certainly goes beyond the K-12 schools, and it certainly goes beyond the College of Education. When you have an educated workforce, business is drawn into a state. I mean, I recently read about a business opportunity that was looking at Wyoming and was looking at a neighboring state and chose the neighboring state because there wasn't a sufficient educated workforce in the region that they were looking to do. So that was a lost opportunity for Wyoming. Hopefully in the future, if we continue to build this really strong foundation in our P-12 system, we can attract more diverse business to the state of Wyoming. And in fact, then everyone has a gain and we can share in those resources that are produced.
Well, thank you for coming and sharing the exciting news about this new initiative, and welcome to Wyoming.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson speaking with Rebecca Watts, the executive director of the Trustees Education Initiative.
After the break, we'll hear from some of the Wyoming legislature's newest lawmakers. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The Wyoming legislative session is underway, and 24 new legislators enjoyed their first week in office. Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports that with budget shortfalls, especially when it comes to education, the newbies have to learn fast.
With such high turnover, it would not be a surprise if some veteran lawmakers weren't just a bit leery about having so many freshmen joining the ranks. But House Majority Leader David Miller says it's a good time for new ideas.
New faces are energizing and exciting. It's nice for the new ideas that are coming in. The new blood is going to help all of us because, you know, individually, none of us have all the answers. It takes a team effort, and the new blood does energize us in the House and the Senate.
The majority of new members actually come from Cheyenne, where they saw state government and the nearby University of Wyoming suffer roughly $250 million in cuts. One of those Cheyenne lawmakers is Republican Senator Affy Ellis. Ellis was a legislative intern in the 1990s and has worked as a lobbyist. But as a legislator, she admits there is a lot to learn.
Well, being a new member, I definitely want to get my feet under me and make sure I understand the complex dynamics of where our revenue streams actually come from and how we're spending those dollars. But there's no doubt that we've got to put our best ideas forward to address that solution or define some solutions.
Another Cheyenne senator who's watched the legislature with a lobbyist badge is Anthony Bouchard. He comes to the legislature with an open mind about how to solve such complex issues as K-12 education funding. But Bouchard has been concerned about spending in recent years. The governor says the state has endured massive budget cuts and that legislators should not cut the budget further and should consider using rainy day funds. Bouchard says he does not agree.
You know, I don't think so. I think we're getting to the end here. Obviously, we can pull money out of rainy day, but we don't want to keep us in a situation where we're going to use that money up in 4 years.
Cody Representative Scott Court nervously says he's still feeling his way through some of these key issues. When it comes to budget reductions, he's noncommittal.
You know, that's a good question. That's a tough situation right now. And again, I'm new and it's a learning experience, but It'll be interesting because we do have a shortfall, so it'll take a lot of work.
But for Casper Representative Debbie Bovee, a Democrat, the answer is easy.
I am very reluctant to do more cuts. I have seen how harmful the cuts are to some of our people most in need. So talk me into any more cuts, you're going to have to show me that it's not going to hurt our people anymore.
Bovee is a retired school teacher who admits she is very worried what the legislature might do to education. Yet at the same time, she believes the majority of lawmakers are committed to an excellent education system. Fellow Democrat Lisa Anselmi Dalton is excited about taking on these challenging issues in the Senate. She is concerned about cutting education funding, but she's also not a fan of raising taxes. She's one of the few who's optimistic, though, that Wyoming's revenue picture may turn around.
Prices are picking up in gas and oil, so we hope we can see a turnaround with maybe the decreased regulation under the Trump administration. That might help Wyoming, so I think that's an optimistic viewpoint. And so my goal would be to try to just weather the storm.
And Selmy Dalton, Ellis, and Bouchard all say that they favor proposals to do what it takes to diversify Wyoming's economy. We will check in with the freshman lawmakers throughout the session. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
On Monday, Wyoming PBS will air a new documentary set in Wyoming called What Was Ours. It's about three Native Americans on the Wind River Indian Reservation and their relationship to artifacts and ceremonial objects and how hard it can be to keep such things within the tribe. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards spoke with two people who appear in the film, Northern Arapaho members Jordan Dresser and former Powwow princess Michaela Sunrhodes.
I first heard about the project about 5 years ago. Back then, they were working on the Wind River Virtual Museum. That was a Wyoming PBS project. And Matt Hames was the director who they selected for it. And he was just looking for people to kind of help him find other individuals. So I started helping him with that. But meanwhile, I was working with the Wind River Hotel and Casino, working with the cultural room. And he just started asking me questions about what I was doing. And then he just started filming me as we created the room. And then my journey through that whole experience.
Yeah. Can you give me some examples of some of your favorite items and just kind of what the process was that you had to go through to get these items?
Some of the pieces are on loan to us from the Episcopal Church. That's a big part of the movie. And you get to see how that kind of goes about and how we initiated that. There's probably about 300 items in that collection. We display 20 of them. I really like the parflesh items because they're very, you just wonder what people had to go through to create them. You know, it wasn't just like going to the store and buying something. It was like you had to, you know, kill the animal and do the tanning and all this stuff. And also the designs behind it.
Michaela, do you want to tell me a little bit about how you got involved in this? Because I know you're a dancer, is that right?
Yeah. Well, I would just go from different powwows all across the country, Canada, and represent my title, not only my title, but my tribe, my family, and who I am as a Indian person. And at the time I was selected, I was 16. And it was towards the end of my reign that the director, Matt Hames, got a hold of me and asked me if I would like to be involved with this. And then
How long had you been dancing and been the powwow princess before that even?
Well, I've been dancing since I was probably about one. I'm really involved with my nieces and nephews, so I'm trying to teach them what I know, what I've learned from my older siblings, my grandparents, my mom and dad. Powwows are more of a contemporary way of American Indians expressing themselves. So our outfits are made out of beadwork, quill work, parflesh, and applique. And beadwork and quill work date back to since before reservation life. And I guess quill work is more kind of the older form of how we expressed ourselves in our art. The quill work of the Arapaho people is very, very beautiful. And it's kind of like a dying work of art for us as Arapaho people. So,
That must have been quite an experience to have filmmakers kind of embed themselves into your life. Can you talk about what that was like?
Actually, the cinematographer that was a part of it, he just made everything so smooth, and I guess that's what a good cinematographer does, is he made it so comfortable that it didn't feel like I was being followed around by big old cameras and a film crew.
Now, there was a third point of view in the film as well. Do you guys mind telling me just a little bit about his side of the story as well?
Philbert McLeod, he was the Eastern Shoshone elder. He passed away, but his story is really about wanting to share and pass on that knowledge. So he's like a big part of it.
And he was a veteran who had a special object that he felt kept him safe when he was at war. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he went to Vietnam. It was given to him by an individual who told him that it would always protect him and watch over him. So that's just a nice ties into that.
It's like a little
beaded medallion. Yeah, and it's just the idea that it goes back to why Native people make things, you know, it's because everything has a purpose.
Yeah. Now, I know that there is the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. Do you mind talking a little bit about why that act is so important in the background of this film?
NAGPRA was a law passed in 1990 because prior to that, anthropologists basically had free reign of Native graves, Native sites, whatever. And that's how a lot of museums collected a lot of the items that they have, is just because anthropologists would go through and collect different items. So there's really nothing protecting Native people. This is a way that NAGPRA helps Native tribes reclaim items of cultural patrimony through institutions that receive federal funds.
And I know a lot of the arguments that those museums make is, well, but where would these tribes put these items if they got them? How would they take care of them? They're safer here in a museum. What would you say is a good place where the tribes can be able to safely bring these items home?
Well, it's the idea that some items were meant to deteriorate and some items were meant to return to the earth. So some items are not meant to be in a glass case.
And so I know that once people have seen this film, they're going to want to know, what your future is going to be. What's next for each of you? Do you mind just sharing what your hopes and dreams are for the next step of your lives?
Well, right now, currently, I'm working on my elementary education degree. So I definitely want to return to the reservation and work at the elementary school there so I can incorporate the cultural aspect of our way of life and involve that in their lives.
Yeah. How about you?
And I just really want to help the tribes expand the Northern Arapaho Experience Cultural Room and work with the tribe's preservation department and hopefully one day build a museum where we could do house more items and display different things and basically tell our story our way.
Yeah. Well, thank you both for taking some time and best of luck with the film and with what is next for you and your futures.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The documentary What Was Ours will air Monday, January 16th at 9 p.m. on Wyoming PBS.
The coal industry is breathing a sigh of relief with Donald Trump about to enter the White House. He campaigned on an energy platform that would strip away Obama administration regulations on the fossil fuel industry. Chief among them, the Clean Power Plan. It would require states to make huge cuts in carbon emissions. Colorado, Wyoming, and North Dakota all sued to stop the plan. Inside Energy's Amy Sisk reports from North Dakota, where opposition was especially fierce.
North Dakota officials faced a major challenge when the Clean Power Plan was finalized in 2015. Reduce the state's carbon dioxide emissions 45%.
Going up.
12 floors up in the state capitol building is Randy Christman's office. The chair of the North Dakota Public Service Commission says that target is unrealistic.
North Dakota had to be two-thirds of that way by 2022. That's only a few years away, and there's no way we were getting there.
The Clean Power Plan assigned North Dakota the second highest emission reduction target in the country. To comply, the state would need to build tons of wind turbines, while likely shutting down coal mines and plants, and putting thousands out of work. The Supreme Court put the rule on hold last year, and now the Trump administration has changed the equation.
They were going to shut the industry down. That does not exist anymore, those fears.
That's Jason Bohr, president and CEO of Lignite Energy Council. The Clean Power Plan's effectively dead. The president could choose not to enforce it, or the Supreme Court could strike it down, all of which is good news for the coal industry represented by Bohr's trade group. There's no longer a timeline looming, threatening closures in coal country. Mines here can keep operating. Where massive trucks haul thousands of tons of coal daily to nearby plants. But that doesn't mean coal's off the hook.
Donald Trump is not the cure-all for the coal industry. This doesn't fix everything. It just gives us the opportunity to provide solutions.
Solutions that, surprisingly, could actually bring North Dakota close to that ambitious 45% reduction target. Here's Dave Glatt with the State Health Department.
But I think that's a good goal to shoot for. We may not hit it necessarily on the exact timelines that the Clean Power Plan was looking at. But I do think that that's something that we should look at, see how viable it is, especially with the development of new technology. Can we achieve that or even go beyond that?
The state will continue to press forward on a new coal-fired power plant that promises zero carbon emissions. It gasifies coal and uses it, along with oxygen and carbon dioxide, to drive a turbine, then recaptures that CO2. And the state's interested in technology under development to send that CO2 deep underground into horizontal wells drilled in the Bakken oil patch. This enhanced recovery method would squeeze more oil out of mature wells. It hasn't been used before in unconventional wells in the Bakken. Christman with the Public Service Commission sees potential.
The value of that CO2, I think, is so significant that it is in the state's best interests. It's in the generator's best interest, and it's in the oil and gas company's best interest to make sure this happens.
Coal remains the biggest source of electricity in North Dakota, and the industry claims there's still 800 years worth of reserves yet to mine. But even without the Clean Power Plan, coal still faces significant obstacles. The American public demands cleaner energy, and the market's headed there anyway. Renewables are on the rise, and natural gas is cheap. But for North Dakota, it's all about keeping coal viable. The state will try to do that with new technologies, plus craft a path forward for the state's booming wind industry. Glatt says coal plants could still shut down.
We'll probably be looking at closing down the first generation sometime into the future, but then replace it with the second generation, which are significantly cleaner and emit less carbon dioxide.
So the effort for a healthier climate spurred by the Clean Power Plan will still take place here, but on North Dakota's terms and its own timeline. For Inside Energy, I'm Amy Sisk.
Inside Energy is a public media collaboration focused on America's energy issues.
Ahead, we'll wrap up the show with a conversation with retired Supreme Court Justice Marilyn Kite on the new Judicial Learning Center. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. This week, the Wyoming Supreme Court unveiled its much-anticipated Judicial Learning Center. It features a movie interactive exhibits, including an area where visitors can be the judge in a case. Retired Supreme Court Justice Marilyn Kite says the idea came from the Colorado legislature that developed a way for citizens to better understand the rule of law. After getting legislative and private money to develop the center, even Kite is surprised with what they came up with.
I didn't think we would be able to accomplish a lot of these interactive exhibits where, you know, the computerization of it is so effective. And frankly, I have to give a plug for Warehouse 21 because they're a consulting firm in Cheyenne. We started out working with folks back east, and they were able to get it done for the budget we had. That's what I'm surprised about, and on time. And then the part of the center that is the Wyoming Judicial Milestones, kind of a great history lesson about Wyoming and the development of the law in Wyoming. And I think I can say that I am kind of surprised about how well that turned out, how interesting it is, and I hope effective for people that visit the center.
Well, why don't I have you just do this? Give us a little thumbnail sketch. If I want to go, what are the things I'll get a chance to see?
Well, first we developed our own movie. Colorado had an interesting short movie, you know, like I think it's 4 or 5 minutes long, that in a humorous, entertaining way describes what the rule of law is. And then you walk through the center. There are probably 8 or 9 exhibits. Most of them are interactive where you can touch the exhibit and get an answer about the Wyoming court system, about judges throughout the state. We have one exhibit that's talk to a judge, and you touch the picture, and then you can listen to that judge answer certain questions. I think my favorite exhibit really is You Be the Judge, which provides a fact situation, a criminal, child custody, and then a negligence case, and there's an issue presented of some sort, a question. You're given what the law is, and then you're asked to apply it and be the judge and determine what the sentence should be. And I think that's what's frustrating sometimes when you're on the judge side of the bench, trying to inform people about what hard it is to apply the law. We all talk about the rule of law, and it's easy to, in most cases, to look up those rules. But applying them to the unlimited number of fact situations that are out there is a tough job. And I think that exhibit really causes people to internalize and understand what it takes to be a judge. Then we have this judicial milestone exhibit that is a wonderful pictorial history of the rule of law in Wyoming and some of our claims to fame, particularly in the area of women's suffrage and women's rights. And we have an exhibit that explains how you become a judge. And our judicial selection process is precious to us all because it is as nonpartisan as is humanly possible process to select judges. So it takes people through that process. And then we have an exhibit which is kind of like the You Be the Judge, but you're given principles and you have to apply it to a – and this is essentially a real case. Some of the facts have changed, but an incident where they prohibited snowboarding in a certain ski area, and some snowboarders challenged it, and you get to decide what are the principles that should be applied to deciding that case.
I would imagine that one of the things you're hoping is this will prompt discussions in classrooms, so it would be even more informative for the students that come visit.
That's exactly right, and there are two things in that regard. One is we worked with the Department of Education and Superintendent Balo to make sure that the content was consistent with the Wyoming Social Studies standards, and so we think the content of the center will both supplement and serve as an aid in teaching those civic skills. And then secondly, we are hoping that lots and lots of students are able to come to the center from all over the state. But if they can't, we are going to have all of the content online hopefully by about February, so they can go through the center virtually, essentially, in their classrooms. And that was something that
Chief Justice Burke felt very strongly about, that he wanted to make sure that the center accomplished, and we're excited about seeing that, and we can revise it as things change.
I know you're excited for everyone to get a chance to come and see it. Justice Kite, always nice chatting with you, and congratulations on this, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
William F. Cody, also known as Buffalo Bill, died in Denver, Colorado on January 10, 1917. 100 years later, his name adorns a 300,000-square-foot museum complex in Cody, Wyoming, the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. That complex holds the Buffalo Bill Museum, but it also houses a research library and four other museums featuring Western art, Plains Indians, guns, and the wildlife and wild places of the Yellowstone area. What else did the world-famous showman leave behind? Penny Preston has the answer.
There are two things that define Cody, Wyoming. Its position as a gateway to Yellowstone National Park and Old Faithful, which delights tourists from around the world. And Buffalo Bill, for whom the town was named. He was considered the most famous man of his time because of his Wild West shows. His shows toured the world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The curator of the Buffalo Bill Museum in Cody, Jeremy Johnston, says when Cody died, it was a big deal.
William F. Cody's passing pushed the news of the growing concerns about America's entry into World War I off of the front page. And a number of dignitaries, including President Wilson, expressed condolences to the Cody family after his passing.
But what did Cody leave behind besides the name of a town, a museum complex, and historical notoriety? Johnston says Cody shaped the way we think about the West.
A lot of those iconic images of the American West stem from Buffalo Bill's Wild West. The attack of the stagecoach, the attack of the homesteader cabin. All of these were recreated in the arena in Buffalo Bill's Wild West. And a lot of Hollywood movies and later on television copied the same images.
Were those images reflections of the real Wild West? Johnston says Cody was very good at dramatizing history.
So he would take authentic events and he would add this element of drama that drew people in, and audiences just loved it. They felt like they were part of these past events that led to the settlement of the American West.
The antagonist in those recreated events were Indians who lost their homelands to American settlers. The actors in Buffalo Bill's shows were real Indians.
When you're watching The Last Stand of the Little Bighorn in Buffalo Bill's Wild West, a number of the Lakota Indians who are recreating this conflict, they were there that day at the Battle of the Little Bighorn.
Ironically, several historians, including Johnston, feel Cody helped the Indians who appeared in his shows.
It's unfortunate because I think one of the more popular images of Buffalo Bill Cody is him as an Indian killer. So the first scalp for Custer. The battle at Summit Springs.
But Johnston says Cody was an advocate for American Indians peoples and Indian rights as he grew older.
And they would travel with him all across the United States. They traveled with him into Europe. And at the same time, they were being paid a pretty decent wage for that time period to recreate their culture in its glory days.
Cody even risked the ire of the U.S. government.
The mission of the United States government was to kill the Indian, save the man, teach them how to farm, ranch, we'll make them into Christians, we'll teach them English. That Plains Indian culture will slowly fade away. And what Buffalo Bill was doing, in fact, a lot of the reformers saw him as a threat, was saying, wait a minute, there's some value here in this Plains Indian culture.
And a Plains Indian Museum is part of the Buffalo Bill Center of the West in Cody. It was the brainchild of his niece, Mary Jester Allen. Johnston says Allen brought wealthy, influential donors from the East to Northwest Wyoming. In the century after his death, they and local families eventually created the group of museums she envisioned.
She had this great vision of not only a Buffalo Bill Museum, but a museum that would interpret Plains Indian culture, firearms. In fact, she also had a natural history museum as part of the Buffalo Bill.
The Buffalo Bill, Center of the West, continues to grow and thrive and helps keep Cody's name alive. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Penny Preston in Cody.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the entire program or individual segments, go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also sign up for our podcast on that website or get it from iTunes. And if you get the podcast, we'd appreciate it if you'd rate it and write a comment. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We'd love it if you liked our Wyoming Public Radio News Facebook page. And you can find all of our reporters on Twitter. You can follow me at C. Ballard News.
And I'm at Butter Bob. And as a reminder, we always like to hear about good story ideas. You can submit those through our website or our Facebook page. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.